So, you know, my intestinal function comes from insects, and this is due to the collaboration with Gilles Laurent when he was in Caltech, and then later on with Brian here. And then my approach is kind of different than most of you have been dealing with, because it's, I'm not coming so much from the olfactory receptor field. Yeah, I'm looking at the function, that we are trying to solve. And my goal is looking at the function, I go back into the circuits of the olfactory system, in particular the insects. And I try to identify what are the minimal elements that will make possible to solve some computational problems. So I hope this angle will help you also and in your own research. So my plan for today is, as I said, I want to look at this as an engineer. So first, I would like to understand what's the computational problem that we are trying to solve. Also, I need to address this issue that Benki raised in the past. What's the role of these fine infinite structures in the brains or the mushroom bodies? This fundamental question, why do we need the mushroom bodies? I want to show how this is extremely similar to some machine learning algorithms that you know, were proposed by Budnick and Thomas Kogar quite a few years ago in 1965. And if I have time, I don't know where I have time, I would like to touch the issue of the gain control, because I think there is some confusion in what gain control is. You are talking about control is you have some object and you want to keep it in a stable position, and then you want to find the algorithm or methodology to keep it in that particular position. So it needs to be in a particular target value. I think most of the things that I've seen in the talks is modulation rather than gain control, modulation or control modulation rather than gain control. Okay. So. Going to the first question, what is it that we want to solve? What's the computational problem? The first thing I want to ask is, what is it that we want to recognize? And the second thing I would like to bring up is that, as has been discussed in several talks already, the way the information is transmitted through the air is different than other modalities, because, of course, you can have diffusion, but also for insects, the main modality of transmission is transmitting the chemicals through turbulence. So it's intermittent pieces of information that are arriving at the sensors. So in reality, we have two ways of transmitting information here. So whatever algorithms you, the biological systems develop need to be able to cope with these two different methods of transmission. So to touch the topic of function. I'm looking at the from the role of computational function, and this is a collaboration with NASA and JPL, Amy Ryan and Margie Homer. They developed these electronic nodes based on polymer sensors. And when you are up in the International Space Station, the goal is to survive, and then it's very important to keep the air quality as good as you can. Of course, you cannot open the window and clean the air. So you need to keep a very strict control of what is in the cabin. So that was one of the goals we have. So one document that the NASA has that I find very interesting is that when they are looking at this problem of keeping their cabin as clean as possible, they have this big book of what they call a spacecraft maximum allowable concentrations. And then they have a bunch of chemicals in here. And then they want to see, okay, the first thing is they want to detect the chemical that is present. The second thing, they have a limit of detection, the threshold, that's the particle per million. And the third thing that is important is the duration, right? I mean, somebody cannot be exposed at higher concentrations at 10 ppm during 1 hour, 6 ppm during 24 hours, or 2 ppm 7 days, and so on and so on, right? In addition to that, they also know what the effects of these gases have on the, sometimes in the central nervous system. For example, look at the alkanes here. They claim that the aerosol effects at 150 ppm during 1 hour. They observe depression, irritation, nose. So they have these things. Think that the military also, you know, they have this large experience putting people in submarines for long periods of time. So sometimes people come out with some mental issues, and somehow after that they analyze what chemicals have been exposed to. So summarizing, so you look at the problem here, there are three things that are relevant. Of course, discrimination of the gas, the concentration, estimation of the concentration, and the time of exposure, right? Now, we also develop our own sensor arrays, and for that, we don't use the polymer sensors from that they developed at JPL. We use the metal oxide sensors from Figaro, which are just semiconductors. And what I want to present you here is a typical response from one of these sensors during other presentation, right? And what the time scale that you see here is real, so this is seconds. And this is the change in the resistance of the semiconductor material. And this is the baseline. And as soon as the gas is present in the chamber, you see this exponential rise, and then it's saturation, right? Typically, the people working in the artificial sensor community, they go ahead and they look at as a main feature, chemical feature, that they use for classification purposes, the difference between the baseline and the top. Now, there is a lot of information going up and down. So one of the problems that you see compared with our, you know, the olfactory receptor neurons that you guys are used to look at is look at the time scales there. So they are fairly slow. Okay. Now,
does that reflect the slow filling of the chamber or the slow set response of the detector?
Yes, the slow response of the detector, very, very slow. So you can make it, yeah.
How does it work? Like,
the binds
and then
the oxygen. As soon as you elevate the temperature, there's a layer of oxygen and the whatever chemical binds onto it, including water. So chemicals, and then as a result of that, the conductivity changes. So we tested. You created the equivalent of an artificial antenna, right? In the wind tunnel, where we have a bunch of, like in this particular case, we have three different gases. And in the back, you cannot see it, but we have a bunch of mass flow controllers that we can control through the computer. And basically, we can change the concentration levels of these chemicals. So we use that as an equivalent of an antenna. What we do is that we place these sensors at different distance from the source. And we are trying to address the problem of classification or identification of odorants. Let me tell you that initially one of the goals we had, of course, is to build a robot. And on top of this robot, we were going to put one of those sensor arrays. Now, when you do that, unfortunately, given the time scales of the detection, I don't want to show you any video because it doesn't look very good, right? So, but nevertheless, I want to show you in this context how you can actually get fairly good performance levels based on these chemical sensors as long as you have enough time to calculate.
How many sensors?
In here we have 8 sensors per board, right? In here. And then we have 9
different kinds of sensors.
So some of the, I'll get into that. There are repeated sensors, but those sensors can be regulated by changes in the heater, in the temperature, which changes the properties, response properties of them. So in a way,
In effect, they are different sensors.
In effect, they can, yeah, they are different.
The goal is to actually tease apart the mixtures in the air.
The goal is, as I'm going to show you now, is first just pure discrimination, and then
individual
odorants, then different odorants. But then we also have mixtures, and we want to identify one in a noise level, right? But I'm going to show you only
not the persistence, but the difference when you change the temperature. Is it changing the sensitivity, the sort of the binding affinity of different orders, or is it just scaling everything up and down?
It's changing a bit the affinity because it's not changing the time scales, right? So, but
generally, being able to sense different odorants differentially.
Yeah, I'm going to show you that.
The temperature, then we wouldn't be sitting here. I mean, you cannot do any sensor without it.
So this is an example of what you get. Yeah, actually we had 10 different gases, and the time scales are real, 260 seconds. So this is what we have. This is for toluene because the army is interested in this type of gases, toluene and benzene, right? Because they're dangerous gases for health. What I want to show you here is that these are a sensor board located at different locations. And this is one of the responses. So my point in here is that just looking at the time series of each of the sensors, you can compare to the others. You can see there are significant differences in terms of how they behave each other. So for example, compare this toluene with the acetone, the acetaldehyde, and the ammonia. So there is a differential response of each of the sensors for the gases, and this is due to, for the reasons I already mentioned, that we change the temperature. But I think it's important to emphasize too, you know, this turbulence that you see in the signal itself due to the way that the gas are delivered into the wind tunnel.
What are the colors?
The colors are different sensors within the port.
And the blue row, the first row, is equivalent to blue in the second row?
Yes, in this way.
And the rows just trials?
The rows are different trials and different locations from the source. So
why in the acetone case, for example, I mean, so you have some very nice replicability?
Yeah, because in these cases, some of the samples I put here are right. Let me show you the twin panel. We put it in. Some of those are. In here and there, so there is no exposure to the gas. So I was just showing some examples.
But why does toluene reach those same sensors?
Because some of the examples I gave you are down
there. So they're not. The different panels aren't matched.
Yeah, sorry. It's just trying to give you a kind of informative sample of the responses.
Okay.
And what's the speed of the air?
I'm gonna get into that. So this is one of the examples of the things we do, right? So you have here the speed that we use in the wind tunnel, meters per second. What you have in the x-axis is the voltage of the sensors. So by changing the voltage of the sensors, you change the temperature. And then in this particular problem, we go ahead and we take all the sensor array, all the antenna you like, take the data from the training position one, which is the closest to the source. And then we test what happens, recognizing in all the other positions. So we have in these colors is the performance in the discrimination task of these 10 gases going from 0 to 100. And here the maximum that we obtain is 80%. So the question that we want to ask in this case is how well we can actually generalize whatever data, whatever model we train in the training position one here, position two, and so on. And one of the results that you see for this particular case is that you tend to do better at higher speeds and pretty much in the middle of the wind tunnel. By the way, all this work is in color. Due to these guys here, Vergara, before I forget, Jordi and Jonas, Marco Tricavelli, and Nikolai, who actually built all the electronic circuits for this. So, and I pull out, for now, one of our papers with Brian. This data that we basically extract features, typically the people at machine learning, they get the time series, and what the first thing they do, they extract some chemical features from the data. And then after that, they apply a classifier, some generic model that solves pattern recognition problems. So I thought that it was interesting to establish the analogy in what type of features we get from these chemical sensors for two different gases at some particular time, which are each of those features. Each of those features, for example, can be the difference between the baseline and the top, or can be the derivatives at different time scales, right? And we just plot here from 1 to 127 comparing to different gases. So what we mostly see is that there is a high overlapping of the responses of the sensors. Now, I took this from Glenn Turner from his talk, and I thought it was interesting to bring this up and show the responses in terms of the spike rate or the olfactory receptor neurons. And then you also see very high overlapping and similarity in the responses in some of the cases for these olfactory receptor neurons. So there are some similarities. In terms of the flow of the transmission information, this is the paper from Justus and Cardet. That's very nice. Basically, they are recording with a photoinitiation detector the concentration of the gas in propane ppm. They observe the same thing that we see, right? That there is this high variability in the wind tunnel of the counting of the particles. And then you see these high frequency oscillations whenever you are close to the source. And then as long as you are moving away from it, this frequency is going down. So while the discrimination is, in principle, can be done fairly quickly with a few features at the beginning, whenever you move into the domain or estimating the concentration levels or the distance to the source, depending on what function you want to solve, then you definitely need to integrate the signal over long periods of time so you capture the time scales of the turbulence. So I think this is important to emphasize. There are these two functions, on one hand, discrimination and classification of different gases. And on the another role is actually to estimate the distance, which cannot be, I think, done in any other way than integrating the signal over some period of time. Okay, so this is kind of the what we kind of converge, I think, everybody, right? What are the main computational tasks that then I try to solve within the context of the inside models is the classification problem, or discrimination, to separate one gas from the rest. I'm not getting into the pictures yet. And also the regression problem, in terms of what the language that they use in machine learning, right? Machine learning, they talk about classification or regression. So we are going to use the same. Now, the regression problem is how to estimate the gas concentration or the distance to the source. I don't know what's more important for the bee, for example. What do you think will be the distance? They would probably be more interested in estimating the distance rather than the concentration itself. Anyway, so that's the regression problem, because it needs to estimate the real value. So now we move into the honeybee model, and then that's when I'm going to start making quite serious simplifications. But all the biologists have been working, they have not been complaining too much for the time being, right? I hope you don't crush me. So I decided to choose, everybody tends to show the same images about the incident of function, and then I got this from Paul Siska, who is a collaborator of Brian, that just showed this X-ray image of the honeybee brain. And then there are these things, right? The information, the areas that I'm going to concentrate the most is in the calyx, which are these big areas of the insect brain. And then the information, as we have been discussing in this, group, in this meeting, is all the issues concerning the reception of information into the antenna lobe. And the information from the antenna lobe is relaying to this big screen, which is the muscle body that has these areas that are called the calyx. And this information is transmitted through these neurons called the projection neurons. And they go into these interesting cells that are called the kinion cells. So that's kind of the main structure. As you can see from here, the muscle body is a big chunk of the honeybee brain. Okay, so now we go into the simplifications. What we want to do is what are the minimal computational elements that we need to solve a classification problem first, and then if we have time, we may think about the regression one. So I want to emphasize in here four aspects, actually. Right? I think the first time I look at this system, what is pretty amazing, is the connectivity, right? So you don't know anything about the brain. The first thing you look at is the connectivity, how these things transmit information from one layer to the next. And then you go from the antenna, right, that has a, in the case of the locust, it has like a total 90,000 receptors. In the honeybees, about 50,000 total receptors. So you have, and I don't know about the Drosophila. What's the Drosophila number? How many receptors?
2,000.
Yeah.
Well, how many
were? Total receptors in the antenna.
60 genes,
but I mean total receptors.
I don't know the number of.
Yeah, but anyways, so I'm talking about the total number of receptors, right? Not the size. So the number of neurons, basically the number.
You want sensory neurons.
Yeah, sensory neurons. Sorry. Yeah, right. So the number of neurons. So here you have like around in the case of the honeybee about 90,000, and then all this information is projected into the antenna lobe, which is a network of excitatory inhibitory neurons. The complexity of the inhibitory neurons, still we don't know. But for the time being, we are going to ignore it. And so the antenna lobe is processing this information coming from the antenna. The antenna can be sensing different levels of concentration in the air. And the antenna lobe is going to process in some way. Some people are talking about, you know, the correlation of the information to separate more the odorants. But the bottom line is that all this information is taken, processed by a group of neurons called the projection neurons. And those projection neurons send information into the big muscle bodies, right? And in terms of the connectivity, we have here about 1,000 projection neurons, you know, so there is a strong convergence 1 to 10 into the antenna lobe. And then when, as soon as you go into the mushroom body, into the calyx, this big area where the information is projected, now suddenly you again expand and you are in the order of 150,000 neurons. So there is a strong fan in of information and a strong fan out. Now, when you go to the output neurons, it's interesting, again, because you have a few neurons again. There are about how many output neurons there are in the honeybee?
In the 300.
In the Drosophila, there are like about 50. So from about 100,000, 150,000, then a few hundred at this level. So this is, you know, the first thing that you look at, this must be doing something, compression, divergence, and compression. The second thing that is really interesting is just looking at the average activity levels of each of those layers, right? When obviously the antenna, these are photoreceptor neurons, when there is a strong, large number of gases and high concentrations, the activity levels are going to be very high or very low. So there is a big variability of responses in this first layer. So lots of variability, which is very hard to process, right? You are doing this in terms of machine learning and trying to solve it. You need to process the data in some way that kind of normalizes the data. So then, of course, people think about the normalization in here. Okay, so but I'm going to concentrate the activity first. So then from here, you go into the antenna lobe. Typically, from the recordings I've seen from several people, I see that they go into activity levels when they record within half a second or so. They see about 10 to 15% activity with some variability up and down, but that's typically what they can record. So there is a reduction of activity from this huge variability to here, and then perhaps that's something that we have time we will discuss, is here there is a smaller variability of the activity. So it's smaller, but the activity, the variance, the standard deviation of the activity goes is more controlled, more smaller. Now, you keep propagating the information from here to there, then suddenly you at this level you have a sparse code. So from high variability to a little bit less variability, less activity to about 1 to 5% activity with very little variability activity. So why do we have this reduction of variability through the layers and reduction of activity? So in a way, the system is getting less activating and in principle is saving energy by doing this. Now, the interesting thing in the output neurons, I think Glenn in a few weeks will show some data, and also we know from Brian's lab, these output neurons suddenly they spike a lot. And obviously that's reasonable because they have a strong convergence of information from 150,000 here into a few neurons. So yeah, by summation of all the sparse activity in this big layer, you can have high levels of activity. So reduction up to this point, and in here you have some sort of integration. And the output neurons, the guys who read the Mason bodies. Okay, so that's
a little bit confusing. So the output neurons get dense connectivity from Kenyan cells, or
dense connectivity from Kenyan cells. Is that correct, Frank? Yeah. So they get. I think Glenn, for example, observes about 50%, but he will give you a talk about that. So it's really huge. And then functionally, he told me that when he actually pokes the neurons, there's about 30% probability of connection from these guys to the output neurons. From the data I'll show you later, Brian, you actually see, you see these big dendritic trees, and they cover quite a bigger space of the Kenyan cell output. Okay. So let's talk about the function. And here, this is the sensors. Well, let me talk from a machine learning perspective, okay, for an engineer. Right? I think it's interesting that you see these similarities in how nature is doing it, and then how a current engineer that works in, I don't know, in a high frequency trading firm or in FICO, just detecting credit card fraud. Actually think. They get the data, the sensors from wherever. And the first thing they think, okay, now I cannot do anything with this plain data. I need to process it and extract the features that are more useful for me. Like what's the frequency of this particular operation, or how often does he go to this particular place? And then he extracts a vector of features that will be fed into the machinery that will solve the classification problem. So. In those terms, it looks like it's very natural to expect that this antenna lobe may be playing this role of feature extraction. Now, exactly what type of features the antenna lobe is extracting, we don't know yet, but you can find in the literature several papers that talk about decorrelation in time. Brian has one about those, that inhibition helps to discriminate similar odors, right? As soon as they block the inhibition, they see that there's not such ability to discriminate. This is with Mark Stoffer and Gila quite a few years ago. But there is some sort of, there must be some sort of feature extraction happening at antenna lobe level. Okay, and now we come to the Mason bodies that I'm going to concentrate today in the Mason bodies because of the connection with the machine learning algorithms, and I think that could be more interesting for you guys to see that you can actually establish this relationship, simple relationship. And it was already Martin Heisenberg that proposed that this was the place where LM was taking place, so this is not new, right? And he was arguing that learning was happening from the cases into the output neurons via the octopamine. I don't know how serious is that considered nowadays that it's regulated by octopamine?
No, I think it's pretty well said.
Because the Drosophila gene told me that they don't observe octopamine on the output neurons and the feeding.
Oh, that I don't know.
Okay, so it may change from insect to insect. But the main idea is that positive reinforcement was regulated by octopamine. And that's a perfect location to have plasticity and learn, solve the classification problem. Then the fourth aspect is about, that I didn't talk much, is about the role of the inhibitory networks. Within each of those layers, there is a strong, you know, network of inhibitory neurons. And antenna lobe is quite strong. And one of the possible roles is, gain control, gain modulation, or whatever you want to call it. And one of the reasons we think that's the case is because if you want to solve a classification problem in this layer, any small variation in the antenna lobe when you build simple models is that it creates exponential variation in the calyx. Okay. So that's kind of the main ideas from a modeling point of view that I thought it was important to emphasize. Now, these are the type of models that we typically use. So, of course, some of them are pretty simple, but whenever you want to understand what's going on in the in terms of the connectivity, I think typically McCulloch Pitts neurons are quite informative because they are basically implementing the most basic form of integration. And basically what it's telling us is that whenever the neuron, in this particular case, let's say this is the Kinion cell, KC, and then you say if it at some particular time window it receives some stimulus at some level, if the sum of all these stimulus given the connections is above some threshold, then it's going to be firing. So based on that principle, you can it simplifies a lot, lots of the theoretical work you can do, because it's a very simple neuron, and then you can make estimates about probability of discrimination and classification problems versus the activity levels, versus the connectivities that you have in this layer versus the thresholds. Now, in a second level, you can use the Grossberg type or Wilson-Cohen. We don't want to hurt anybody, so Grossberg said that.
You show Grossberg everywhere.
That's right, that's right. But so, yeah, Grossberg might have been the first proposing this. So basically, in the Grossberg type, you are in, they are kind of in a way measuring the firing rates. These neurons and it contains basically the integrating mechanism as in the McCulloch Pitts, only that it has a dynamic integration with some time scales. So whenever you want to take into account the time scales, these are very convenient, and they are actually very convenient if you want to solve problems like gain control. Because you can do some analytical stuff. And then verify it. And then the next level is verify. We can go to those estimations from the McCulloch-Pitts, estimations from the Wilson-Cohen-Grossberg, and then move into the Hodgkin-Huxley. These ones help you to determine what the connections are best, what the thresholds are optimal, and what's the level of activity that you need in each layer. And then you go to the Hodgkin-Huxley, which are basically the integration is quite close. You know, it's just the summatory over the with some synaptic weight, with the release of the neurotransmitter versus the voltage level of the neurons in the PNs in this case, multiplied by the rectifying current in respect to the reverse potential, right? So in this case, the excitatory reverse potential. And then you have all these other well-known synaptic intrinsic ionic channels that will create a very rich and interesting dynamics. But the mechanism for integration is basically very similar in each of those. And that's basically, so we can translate some of the phenomena, some of the metrics that we obtain for this and for that can be translated in the Hodgkin-Huxley, but it's not as trivial as one may think. Okay. So now let's keep this simplification. So as I mentioned earlier, we want to look at what are the minimal components that we need to solve a classification problem, and then we are going to be concentrated on the Mason body as the main machinery for learning, following the Heisenberg hypothesis, and. So then we had these projections from the antenna lobe into the calyx or the Kinion cells, as already mentioned. Some of the interesting things that you can see in the connectivity from here to there is that in order to have a sparse activity and to solve the problem, you actually don't need learning. You can do a pretty good job without any sort of learning in here. And despite there have been efforts to find STDP between this layer and that, it has never been found. STDP or LTP or LTB in this particular layer. So that's interesting. Now, we have here is this stage one, right? This projection into the calyx. This is like a big screen. And the main idea is that we have a sparse activity. And as soon as you talk about the sparse activity, you ask the statistical mechanics people that have been working with whole field networks, associative networks, whenever they see a sparse, they immediately think about increasing the capacity of associative memories. So then that's always a good indication that something must be going on at that layer in terms of plasticity. You have sparse activity. So those ideas that come from these strange fields like physics and so on might be useful translating it in here and finding hypotheses that guide experimental hypotheses. So okay, so here we know that we have a sparse code. And then what we need in the output neurons is plasticity from here to there. And there are, I will show you later, there's quite a few papers that show that there are plasticity from these neurons to the output neurons. And then we also need to organize competition in the output neurons via some sort of inhibition. We don't know what type of inhibition is. But in a way, we need to be able to organize the different groups of neurons respond to different classes or different types of behavior. Right?
Are you saying that all of this is necessary for testing the error in the spaceship?
This is all necessary to solve a discrimination, a classification problem. All gases.
It's a model of how you think the insect is.
Yeah, yeah, it's a model, yeah. Right. You were sleeping.
Like it's an overkill, I would say.
It's a,
because there are already existing sensors that do the job quite well.
Yeah, yeah, that's the typical. It depends on for what is it that you want to detect.
What you want to know that there isn't too much of certain compounds in the air.
Yeah, for what the NASA wants, there are sensors for some of those things, but not for all of them.
Good.
Okay.
It's even better.
It's good for
most of an overkill.
Yeah. So there, these models are an overkill, but that's the whole purpose. And I guess the insect olfaction is.
You know, do you need Hebbian plasticity for that? For sure not.
For sure you do.
Although, unless you want to have self-learning sensor.
You want to provide to the machine, train the animal to solve some classification problem which is not innate. Then you need to provide positive examples and negative examples, and then you need to plasticity to be able to differentiate. I mean, if Brian here can create any, I mean, these honeybees are super smart, can create any sort of a space for problem for classification where he creates A plus with one type of odorant and B minus for another one, and then later he can switch it. And still, the protocol of using the protocol of Prosbos's extension, it can learn both tasks. So they are extremely plastic, and they don't have they don't need to have connections that never change. There's the functional plasticity is there during behavior.
I think the hardest part is that if you're using pure machine learning, that thing you can just do supervised learning. You don't need self-organizing.
No, that's right. I mean, this
is a regression. In fact, coming to mind, maybe we should just bring a few fruit flies on board.
Mm-hmm. Actually, they did that, I think. I don't know, but I think there were some. They brought a bunch of insects. Yeah.
But it's also the case that you never have one of those odors. You always have lots of those odors potentially present on a spaceship, and it's changing through time.
Yeah.
Right, so that's why. If I'm going to be stuck in a spaceship, I'd rather have a smart sensor with me.
But, you know, it's interesting that you say this is an overkill because to many people this is such a wild simplification.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So you're just in the right position.
Yeah, this is great. Yeah, okay, so then we need, in order to solve classification problems, is you need inhibition in this output neuron, so you have contrast between the output and group of neurons that will be responding to particular behavior. These numbers over here is just the percentage of neurons in the whole brain, so the PNs is about 2% of the whole brain, and the KC is about 35% of the honeybee brain, and the output neuron is only about 0.1%. So I think that gives you an idea of the importance of the mushroom bodies. Okay. Okay, so I think, Venki, it's too bad that Alex is not here because the question was raised about why do you need the mushroom bodies? And if in reality you just can solve this problem with a linear classifier just from the antenna log, that's true. I mean, there's no question that you can get the time series, the signals directly from antenna log, and you can solve the classification problem, not perhaps at the highest level, but to a sufficiently high end level that matches what the insect can do. Right? So what I'm going to give you is both sides, so we can establish some dialogue and discussion, and hope lighting. So well, let's start with the cons. What's the, what are the problems of these finite structures, right? And what we have in this graph is, this is using the simple Makulov pits, but this can be reproduced in some other type of models for the most part. What I have here is the probability of activation in the antenna log layer, assuming some time window of, let's say, 15 milliseconds, for example. And what you have here is the probability of activation of the KC layer, right? So when you solve this problem, right, and you ask yourself, okay, so typically the system will be sitting in here. So about 12% of activity will drive the system about below 10% activity in the mushroom bodies. But the problem with this finite structure is that you see, you start having some noise up and down here. Then you have a wide variation of activity in the Kenyon cell layer. So that's, in terms of computation, that's very problematic. And why it's problematic? You solve theoretically a discrimination problem and calculate what's the probability of discriminating one particular gas from the rest. And this is the probability of having failures, so no proper discrimination. So you just train one odorant respect to a bunch of the others. And then you can train the system such that there is basically no error if you are in this activity activity levels in the cases for this particular simulation. This is the total number of neurons in the calyx. Multiply the probability by the probability of activity, which is this number over here, right? So in this particular case, we have that. So as long as the activities are in here, right, then it's OK. But as soon as you have a wild variation of activity and you jump there, then suddenly the in terms of how the equations work, you're going to have a failure and it's not going to be able to solve the classification problem. So this is such a serious inherent instability of this finite. So you need, yes?
What is exactly your finite? What does the matrix look like? It's just randomly?
Yeah, OK. So let's get to that point, too. I don't want to hide it. So in this case, it's a Bernoulli process, how we generate it with some where the probability of having a connection is PAL. OK? PC, it's another probability which is pretty low. It's about 10%, sorry. So it's a low probability of connecting the antenna log from to the Kenyon cells. So it's a Bernoulli process. And the reason we do it with a Bernoulli process is when you do the analytics, it's much easier. Now we know in reality that this is not the case. Glenn was showing us that there are some significant correlations. But at least these type of calculations allow you to provide some lower bounds to metrics, right? But when people talk about random connections and so on, I'm the first one to blame is that first, you need to introduce the statistical independence in the equations, so things are much easier. And then once you get nice equations and so on, then you are carried away and you go ahead and make the hypothesis that therefore the system must be creating random connection, which is not the case. So, but that's a typical.
I thought the mouse, they all actually had evidence for it.
For what?
The mouse thought. They are supposed to be random connections.
Yeah, random connections, okay.
Mouse is almost zero. I think it's have much more direct
connections. What's the stuff from Richard Axon?
Yeah, axons are spread all over the different vortex.
What's that?
That isn't really connected. Right? They just showed the axons are going to arbitrary places in the peripheral vortex. So you infer, therefore, they're going to the digit. It's much more indirect than flies. They're explicitly shown. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Sophie Garon, Glenn was showing some of the data. I don't know whether you remember, but Glenn was showing some of the data. There was actually some correlation there. So we assume here. Yeah, but we want to make our life easier. So at least it provides, but you see, despite there are these problems, what it is telling you, even if there are some correlations in the activities, you can also run the simulations and you will face the same sort of problems, which is variations of the antenna log in this type of final connectivity without any additional mechanisms of gain control or inhibitory modulation is going to create a lot of problems for you. Now, let me show you a little bit on those inconveniences. This is the work of Thiago Mosqueiro This is the data from Brian and Martin Strubelos. These guys were able to record with the electrodes both in the antenna lobe and in the output of the output neurons. And then what you see here is kind of the rasters of activity. Maybe Brian is going to be much better spending that for several trials. And then they measure the simultaneously. That's the nice thing, the nice tools that they have. They can record simultaneously the activity in the TNs and the extrinsic neurons. And then what we are plotting here is the instantaneous firing rate that are happening in the TNs and the extrinsic neurons. So what we did is we fit a model to this type of responses. By the way, Martin and Brian were showing here, which is a very interesting thing, and we are not going to talk today, but basically they were able to detect that the extrinsic neurons were sensing the stimulus earlier than the TNs. That's something.
No. They reached peak classification faster than PNs, but the fastest responding PNs were always still faster.
The argument in there was that due to the fact that you are making sampling a small number of PNs, you are not looking at the whole distribution of PNs, while the extrinsic neurons are looking, since they have this big convergence of connections, and basically looking at all these guys, they can feel those ones that are not recorded here that have a faster reaction. Tiago got the data, and then, you know, just did the, in this case, we fit it not a Hodgkin-Huxley because it was too long. We did an integrated fire. The integrated time fire model is one, in case you don't know, is that it has some passive rectification, and whenever the synaptic input reaches some level, then it goes ahead and it produces a spike, artificial spike. What he fit for experiments and simulations, so I'm not going to get into the details of how he fit it, but he managed to get a very good match between experiments and simulations using realistic connections, as we know from the theory.
Would you say what EN stands for?
It's extrinsic neurons or output neurons, sorry. So those are the neurons that are reading out the kinion cells. So extrinsic neurons.
So the PNs are the output of the antenna.
Yeah,
so the PNs are the output of the mushroom body. So we're
those
trying
to figure cells.
No.
They're
kinion
cells that are
active. The output neurons of the kinion cells, right?
The output neurons are listening to the kinion cells.
Yeah.
Yes. So what we're looking at there is a transformation.
So the EN is MBOTs, the mushroom body output neurons.
Yes.
Okay. That's right. Yeah. So sometimes sometimes we call it EN and sometimes we call it output neurons. Yeah. Okay. So let's go to the thing that probably many of you can expect, right? When you run these simulations, and then the question is, what is the advantage of having a bigger kinion cell layer? And what you're looking in here is the average instantaneous firing rate for different levels of mushroom body size. Maybe we move not to those, to these guys here, which is more clear. Here he has 1,000 neurons, here he has 4,000 neurons. And as you can see, this is the errors, right, of all the runs that he is. So when the kinion cells are, the size of the kinion cell is small, then the variability of the time series is smaller than when you have bigger size. So
Ramos, can you just back up one second? So you're varying the kinion cell size. So everything else is held constant, the number of antenna lobe neurons,
but
the connectivity is obviously changing.
That's good observation. So what Tiago is doing actually is, for every size, he goes ahead and refits the model to get all the parameters right.
Yeah, so and in some sense, there's more fan out when you have KC. Yeah. It's not just in cells that increase the number.
So he's trying
to. That's the variance, but not the coefficient of variation.
Yes, that's pure the variance, yes. So.
Yeah, so the coefficient of variation would be going way down, right?
Probably, yes. I cannot, this is a paper that we're writing now, but that's some.
Wait a minute, so the purple is the instantaneous firing rate, right?
The line going in between those guys.
Yeah.
So that's all the variation that you see.
So it does look like the coefficient variation is going up, mm-hmm. despite the fact that you actually have a larger N, which is therefore a little bit surprising, isn't it?
No, but I think. He plotted in here the response variance versus the size.
Yeah.
And then it's going up the variance of the. Or the response across many trials.
But that's the absolute variance you're plotting there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And but Chuck was asking about the coefficient of variation, but it looks like
that would be going way down, because the coefficient of variation is the standard deviation over the mean.
I guess it depends on whether you.
Yeah. Oh, right. I see what you mean. Zero. Yeah, probably going down.
I was assuming the bottom zero.
Okay, we'll have to do that. Yeah. So that remains, right? But the bottom line in here is that one of the problems we have again with this fan out is that if you have small fluctuations due to noise in the antenna lobe, it's going to be propagated, generating noise during the fan out phase. So it would be it's good to design systems to control it. So okay. So fan-out systems amplify everything, even the bad stuff, and it seems that gain control or gain modulation systems are needed. And this is actually the case because there are, as we know, there are some, already was Jin Wang was showing us that there is some gain modulation antenna lob. Some data from Mark Stoffer in the locus when they do electrophysiology shows that there is actually very strong gain control in the antenna lobes. But in addition to that, you also need some mechanisms of gain control in the mushroom bodies. And there are these huge inhibitory neurons called the PCPs in the honeybee that are pretty much reading everybody. And they appear to have some role in the inhibition due to the fact that they read everybody. So it seems like a general principle that at every layer, no matter what you do, is good always to have some controls of activity, such that things do not go out of control.
Can you say what to use them, what the them is?
Can go to the systems and anyone wants to use them.
The fan-out system.
The fan-out.
If you want to use the fan-out system.
Yeah, because the argument at the beginning was that you really need the mushroom bodies and so on.
I got it.
So, I was trying to put all the negative aspects of what you need to make it work. Okay, so now let's discuss a little bit the pros. And I remember one of the questions that we had was with Glenn. Glenn was running. I actually have the slide here. Let me go. Yeah, this is the Glenn's slide, right? And then he was showing that there's a sparse activity in the mushroom body, and then what he applied is just linear classifier to separate one from the other, right? And then the question immediately was, I forgot who, but you can do the same at the antenna level, and that's actually, I think, is correct. I mean, you can actually do it. Okay.
Alex Lewis.
Okay. Yeah, you can definitely do it. But now let's argue about a generic classifier. And then this is a nice example that was actually brought very early on when I was doing my PhD, actually got into the IBM place with artificial neural networks. So that's my interest in between neuroscience and machine learning. And a classical, back then, the artificial neural networks, it was really hot. You know, it was going to solve everything, right? And the classic example that you would find in the books is this Shor problem. And the reason why people propose artificial neural networks with different layers is that these kind of Shor problems cannot be solved with linear classifiers. And let's assume for a second just an example. This is my classifier. And let's say that whenever there's sufficient input, then this is going to be positive. It's going to be firing. And whenever there's no sufficient input, it's going to be silent, a very strong simplification of a neuron, right? My goal in here is just to put this neuron in here at different angles, right, and ask the following question. Can I separate the green odorants from the blue ones? That's the question, right? So then you can spend long hours trying to place this thing, right? Of course, wild simplification. Let's call this a PN2 and this is PN1, right? And this is activity in some reference space. And then you can see that no matter what you do, how many hours you spend doing this, there is no way that you're going to separate only the greens from the blue ones. This is a classic example in all the books that propose to use nonlinear classifiers. So Thomas Cover in 65, his thesis, actually he sent me the thesis, he was nice enough to send it to me. And he said, well, back then they were building these electronic circuits, so they also had to solve this problem with very simple circuits, like this one, right? Linear classifiers. And then he said, well, this is there's a very easy solution for to solve this. You just increase the dimension by one or more. And what happens when you do that is that you can use the very simple circuit, electronic circuit or neuron, and then you can find a classifier, a neuron that separates the blue from the green. So that's the main theoretical argument that why this is useful. In 85 came Budnick with the idea of the support vector machines, and he basically proposed the same idea that in some non-separable problems, in order to make it separable, you create a non-linear projection into a high-dimensional space, which is going to be this. And in that high-dimensional space, you can use very simple linear classifiers to solve it. So when shall we use non-linear classifiers? When the input space is sufficiently complex. Now, if the input space is not complex, it can be it's linearly separable, then you don't need the Maslow boxes. But if it is, definitely it helps a lot to have them. So that would be the argument. If depending on the complexity of the problem, you may need them or not. You have a smart insect like the honeybee that is capable of solving lots of classification problems, as far as I know. When I went to this conference with the Germans there, they said they can solve pretty much everything. They claim they can solve everything. They're super smart. Then they can solve really complex problems, and for that you can use a high dimensional space where you can solve the classification problem. So that's the main argument. This is not new. Again, it was in the artificial neural network domain. It was proposed by Thomas Cover in 65 in his thesis, and then later on in the statistical machine learning theory on the support vector machines, Budnick proposed exactly the very same idea, projected into a simple space where things are separable, and then you build a classifier. Okay. Another argument in favor of using nonlinear classifiers versus linear, this is a recent paper of some guys that actually compare tons of different classifiers. Here it says 179 classifiers. Right? And then you have here this discriminant analysis, that's what Glenn used. And this is a nice example. Bayesian neural network support vector machines, decision tree rule based, blah, 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 blah. And then random forest. This is nowadays, just if you're curious about this, this is the most popular classifier nowadays. Everybody is using them. Okay. So told them that. And then they went to the UCI machine learning repository, and then there are tons of data sets. We also have all the gas sensing data that we collect in the wind tunnel and some other stuff. We also have it there. So they compared 221 data sets, and then they ran it. I mean, they did this massive experiment, comparing all of them. And they published in this journal, which is the top journal in machine learning. All the students go bananas when they see this journal. So, in principle, you can rely on that as a good source, right? It's, it will be for you guys like the neuron or that. So I want to show.
Can you say briefly what a random forest is? I don't know what that is.
Yeah, do you know what a decision tree is by any chance?
What a
decision tree.
Decision tree, yes.
Okay, good. So a decision tree is a collection of decision trees in which each decision tree is looking at different features of the input space. Like you have 100 different features, and then you have built a decision tree on only 10 of the features selected randomly. And then you get another decision tree, and you select another 10 random features and build another decision tree. Then you build about 100 decision trees, and you vote them. Yes, system?
You vote.
That's an exhaustive, stochastic. Yeah, but there are some. I mean, there is some theory behind, right? But the beauty, the reason why it becomes so successful is so simple to implement. It's the although in many occasions the SVMs work better, but let's not get into that today.
What about these deep learning networks?
The deep learning, it's something actually that, you know, there's a lot of controversy, as you know, with that, right? Because you go to the experts in machine learning, you go to the computer science department at UCSD, they will tell you, they are using something that was known since the 80s and so on, right? But I think what it really has is that what is happening now compared to what they didn't have back then is now they have this powerful, Google has these powerful computers, and they can run these unsupervised algorithms to extract features, you know, just running it, right? So it's basically finding correlations in the input space. And it's interesting to see when they run these things and they analyze it a posteriori, they find very interesting correlations in there, because they find grandmother cells, equivalent of grandmother cells that represent faces or cars at a higher level. So, but and that you use those, you don't have a clear idea of what features are best for your classifier.
The random forest is also not doing that. It's taking all features and bagging
them. The random forest will take the whole vector and then select randomly, typically the square root of the number of features. So you will take, actually you can test it very easily in MATLAB. You have it, it's three buggers. It's so easy to implement quickly.
And out of curiosity, do you find that the most important evidence comes from certain subsets of features, namely, does it be feature selection at the end, or do they all sort of contribute?
It's an ensemble, it's just the thing. It's an ensemble of many of them, and then Brayman, the creator of this brilliant idea, for its simplicity, has some theory behind. But I then look into the details of this, so they have bounds here and there of the generalization error.
Yes, so quick question.
Yes.
Am I correct that in the previous slide you showed that the conventional support vector machine did almost as well? Was that the point of the...
Okay, so this is the slide?
I think he'll explain it more here.
Oh, there was something.
Let me. Yeah. Because if you go to the paper, you can look at it yourself.
Can you put some of this on the wiki space?
Definitely, I will. I might be going, but next week for sure I will.
Whenever you get a chance.
Okay. So then these guys did this amazing job of running Loom for months. And then they have this score of classification. To be honest, I don't know exactly what metrics is this, so I don't want to explain it that, but they have here the average performance across all the samples, right? And then what they have here is, let's go in here. So the very first, they have random forest SVMs, the nonlinear SVMs, okay, with different kernels, right, polynomial, and again the random forest, another neural nets with ELM kernels, that's a specific type of nonlinear kernel, SVMs, and all of these guys are nonlinear classifiers, okay? So, and then you need to go really down in this list. I will upload the paper, okay? So you guys can look at the whole list, and then you really need to go down to see when the linear classifier is actually working. So depending, the bottom line is depending on the complexity of the problem. If it is separable, you definitely can do it without the need of using the SVM. But you have to solve complex problems, the SVMs are going to be very useful. Okay, so those are concerning the pros. I think I already talked about this, so I'm going to skip it. So the main idea is that, you know, we don't need learning there. We need a sparse. So I'm sorry, this is a repetition. This is the slide, the beautiful slide from Glenn. He also has beautiful slides that of the output neurons that we give in when you guys have the conference about the output neurons. He showed me beautiful data on it. Anyway, so he built the linear classifier on here, which is equivalent to an SVM. Okay. From this slide, I just want to emphasize all the evidence out there about learning in the Mason bodies. So there are all these papers. The more recent are from Yale and Stein, Kassner, and so in STDP, actually, from here to the output. And also some formal LTP in the output neurons from Mensah group with Martin, that has collaborated a lot with Brian, and also is the co-author in the data that about simultaneously recording the PNs and the extrinsic neurons. Okay. This is data from Stein, Caltech, and remember that one of the in the simplified model that I need to build to solve the classification problem, I was arguing that I need inhibition in the output neurons. And so let's concentrate only in this particular data that Stein passed me, right? And basically, what he sees is he's taking two output neurons recording simultaneously. And then what he sees is that there are very small IPSPs into neighboring output neurons whenever there's one of these guys spiking. But he claims that he finds this strong inhibition with high probability. So yeah, you see that that's the scale. So it's pretty strong GABA A connections, IPSPs. Okay, so that's concerning the evidence on the inhibition in the output. Now, what about the plasticity? What I need to put in the model to make it work? There's again nothing new. There are all these guys that have proposing the similar type of rules using reinforcement learning. So you just go to the literature, research those people, and they have very, very similar ideas. The basic idea of this learning rule is that whenever you have coactivation of the cases and coactivation of the output neurons, then you increase the strength of the connection. This is a very simple rule. Whenever there is positive reinforcement. Okay, if there is negative reinforcement, this is what these guys propose. Then you reverse the rule. So when this particular connection is not doing what it's supposed to do, instead of increasing it, you just change the sign up to minus one. And this over here is just a time scale that you put in the learning, and that's going to be a parameter of the model. So there is nothing new. I just put learning from the cases to the output neurons according to what people have proposed in the simple rules that have proposed in the literature, and they work nicely. Now, I think Brian already showed you this. So what's the source? The question is, what's the source of this reinforcement signal? And this is the results, the data from Martin Hammer that he published in Nature quite a few years ago. And Brian already mentioned it, but I'm going to repeat it here. There are these giant neurons called BAM neurons that are connected to the gustatory input. And in the Nature paper, he shows this figure in which when they give sucrose to the insect, then they record this activation of this neuron that lasts quite a long time. I don't have the time scales here, unfortunately, but this is several seconds. I think this is the stimulation for 1 second, and this lasts for several seconds. Okay, so this is a potential pathway of reinforcement learning going into the Mason bodies. But look at this, this is something that Brian has been investigating a lot lately. It also comes into the antenna lobe. So whatever reinforcement signal is coming from the gustatory inputs not only go to these guys, the big guys here, they also go into the antenna lobe. And that's one of the questions we are trying to investigate. What is the advantage in introducing some learning that a plasticity at the antenna lobe? Do these guys release dopamine or what?
Dopamine.
Yeah. Okay, let me talk about another advantage of having the Mason bodies, and that's going to be robustness. And if you build this machine inspiring olfaction, I mean, you may question that I'm leaving lots of things behind. But in a way, I'm trying to respect, as already mentioned, the connectivities, the activity levels, the location where the plasticity occurs, and the fact that there is a strong inhibition here and there. So we apply this machine, right, to that replicates the insect muscle bodies to different databases, right? And one of them is we chose the NIST database, which is the visual system, but of course we also deal with the olfactory system. And the main message of this graph that we did is the following. What we have in here, this the NIST database is like 10 different classes, 10 different symbols that we introduce into the muscle body like they are odorants. And what you have on the y-axis is the probability of having the proper classification. So whenever you have 1 means that you are not making any mistakes. Whenever you have 0.2 means that you 20% of the cases you are not classifying. 80% of the cases you are not doing the proper classification. So again, we are going to play with the number of neurons in the cases with all the gain control put in place. And it happens something obvious, right? Which is as you increase the size and you measure the performance again in the test set, then you see that it goes high, and then you can go to higher numbers. But for this particular problem, it goes up very, very slowly. So, but every time you increase the size, it's actually getting better. So depending on the problem, you may choose to cut here or there, or even earlier, so you save some energy. Now it can be different for olfactory data. So the bigger the Kenyan cells size, the number of Kenyan cells, the better it's going to do solving classification problem. Again, we have the same for other data sets. But this is a very nice example because it has 10 classes and 65,000 examples and 10,000 for tests. It's a classic example for solving classification problems. Now let's go to the main message, which is this. And this is the argument in favor of using muscle bodies too. Let's forget about this line in here. And this is a experiment that we have planned with Brian. And then what you have is the fraction of removed cells in the muscle bodies after you had trained the animal, the model, sorry, not the animal. But that's so you have learned. So initially you have trained as before with sufficiently high number of Kenyan cells, and now you say, okay, if I don't remove anybody, I get quite decent classification performance. Now, I start damage 10% of the cases, and there is no drop. And I keep damaging, and the drop in performance doesn't go down. And then you need to go to this level of 99% when the probability of having the proper recognition starts to drop very abruptly. This is something that occurs in a large number of data sets. So this is interesting because something that not many people is aware that the muscle body is not only a good device for solving nonlinear classification problems, but also confers a lot of robustness in data, so for pattern recognition. So once you...
Just to make sure, in a sense, in your machine learning thing, you have a whole bunch of muscle body output cells, and that's feeding to a classifier, which is giving the answer, and you're removing...
No, the output, not the Kenyan cells.
The Kenyan cells.
The Kenyan cells are feeding into the output neurons.
And is it output neurons a single classifier? What represents your actual classifier?
We have 10 group of neurons. Each output neuron is going to be representing a different class. So
the identity of the output is giving you which order
classifier
things.
That's right.
So then you're removing the Kenyan cells here.
Yeah, and then here, once you train it, mm-hmm. Then you start removing.
Did you get a sense of the distribution of the weights from the Kenyan cell to these?
I don't remember. That's in the paper with Thomas, right? So
that's very sparse, then you wouldn't necessarily get this, right?
Yeah, that's right. But think like we are not so much. Yeah. So the thing is that the output, the number of connections going into the output, that's typically pretty high, like 20-30%. So yeah, that's definitely the case. But I will also upload that as a note, so we can look actually at it. We do have it in the paper, with Thomas. In here, we have actually the distribution of weights.
What is the number you started with here? I mean, once you delete 90%, you're far below this critical. If you go back to the other slide, it's you have some hysteresis.
I mean, in the sense, think that if I recover the connections that I had before, but with the same weights, I get the same. But this is the result after I train the.
Yeah, I understand. But then basically in the previous plot, you would be already in the regime where you cannot even learn.
Yeah. Let me go again. Yeah, it's not that. So here you train the animal, you know, the model with 100 neurons. You train it, and this is the performance you get. Now, okay, in that context, I would go here, and I would not have this graph, okay? I will start from here. Mm-hmm. And then I will start damaging, and then I don't know in this particular case, but I assume that at that level it will start to drop. You understand?
Right. But if you go to 90% damage here, you're not in the regime where you will never be above the regime where can you learn 100.
Above?
You just start with 100.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, yeah. So I don't know exactly how you relate the critical point in here with the learning.
Could I ask you what the little triangles on top are with the 99%, 99.2%?
You mean these guys?
Yeah.
This is the performance during the classification task. So in this case, we had 10 different classes, and then what we are asking is, you present a new input pattern, and then the output neurons is going to tell you, what number this is, and it may tell you 3. If the number that you introduce is actually 3, this is correct.
And then what are the diamonds with the
areas? Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, we'll get into that. Yeah.
And the fraction of removed cells, the ones that are removed are the projection, are the remote, the output neurons?
No, the cases.
Those are Kenyan cells.
The Kenyan, yeah, Kenyan cells. So, I mean, make it clear, that's important, yeah. So these guys.
Okay. Those are the fraction removed. And so you're saying that after it's trained.
After it's trained.
Before it's trained, you'd have that other graph.
Yeah.
But after it's trained,
you can
take almost everything away and it still works.
But doesn't that sound like almost overkill in the degree of robustness you need? And surely flies never have a situation where they lose
maybe
almost 100% of their brain.
But
you have to stop killing. You are overkilling all the time.
I don't want to. This is not the time to discuss that. Maybe we can do it later for the wine. But this structure of finding out, when I give this talk to people working in hippocampus, they immediately think about the hippocampus, and I don't say anything. That's Nick Strausfeld saying that. So
the assumption is that just one Kenyan cell left over that you didn't destroy is enough to activate the output neuron. Is that the idea?
No one. I mean, you need to have.
If you take away 95% of Kenyan cells and you don't degrade the output, that must mean that any Kenyan cell that still fires is enough to activate the output neuron.
After training.
Is that right? After training, yeah.
Okay, do the classification. Okay. Huh? Not to activate. It is sufficient to do the classification.
The classification is activating the.
You have to
Yes.
Could you specify what the classification task was and how complex it was?
Yeah, that's right.
That must be the key to this somehow.
So again, we tried different examples, and we chose this one because it's a classic example. The classification task is the MNIST dataset, which is made of 60,000 of handwritten digits. And it has 60,000 for training and 10,000 for testing. So during training, you take one particular digit, right? And then you run it through the classifier according to the rules I gave you. It's going to change the connections appropriately. Then you choose another random example. You train and the plasticity and so on and so on.
So there are 10 classes you need to
set. 10 classes.
And there's some variability in each of the 10 classes. And how big was the mushroom body before you started ablating?
In this particular, we use 50,000.
50,000?
Yeah.
So maybe what's going on here is the vast over-representation
of
the classes.
Yeah.
And the problem for olfaction is very different, mm-hmm. right? Because the number of olfactory molecules is enormous. It's not 10 classes, it's many more.
But
classification.
But it depends how you train it. I mean, we are asking about solving a supervised classification problem, not an unsupervised one. So. in the context of what behavioral experimentalists do, they say, I want to train the animal to do this set of behaviors given this set of inputs. And from that point of view, you reduce the dimensionality of the output, because we are not claiming that the animal in an innate manner can recognize those odorants. Obviously, it's the case. We are claiming that the animal at that level can learn a classification task using this module. So again, we are not claiming that. Obviously, some way, somewhere else, it can actually detect it. But it's about training the insect, the model, to solve this behavioral paradigm. And we'll get into one of those examples later that we published in Journal Neuroscience recently. Yes?
Well, in terms of how natural this is, would a fly or a bee ever expect to lose ganglion cells? And that hasn't really been looked at, but as they age, you do see a lot of oxidative damage in the brain, where, you know, they could conceivably start to lose cells at a certain point.
Yeah, we can, you like, we can keep discussing that. And then you had the question, not this one. Yeah, about these guys, right? Okay, so this is actually the damage into the antenna lobe, which is not so surprising. So obviously you damage the antenna lobe, and then you have a major impairment in the recall.
Could you repeat in this setup how sparse the activity in the mushroom body was?
We chose, let me remember, because it's in the paper. I think it's 5% the optimal value that we chose. I think because we, again, scan it, right? We did this cross-validation, and then the model is cheated, because we clamp the activity levels in the cases by hand. And then we sweep it during cross-validation, and then we say, okay, this is the optimal activity level in the ganglion cell. And that, as far as I remember, it's a 5%.
So is this robustness following from the sparseness of the activity in the mushroom body? Because there's a dense representation in the antenna lobe, so you know any damage will lose stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, it's
many. And are these randomly chosen cells you're destroying, or are you destroying
random cells? Yeah, random cells. Yeah.
So let me make sure I understand. The Kenyan cells plus the output neurons with learning are just basically something very close to an SVM.
Yeah, well, I'll get into that briefly.
Ramon, I think getting pretty close to, I don't know how much you have.
I actually would like at least to address his question.
Okay.
Is that possible?
No, of course it's possible. I just don't know how much more you have.
What I have here left, but maybe you can discuss it with Brian, is the paper we published in the Journal of Neuroscience about translating this model into the extension model of proboscis extension and retraction, and how we can apply it to one particular behavioral paradigm. Okay, but get to the question. I'm glad that you asked this question, because I had it in here. So let me make the analogy with SVMs, you know, and let's put it, and this is also is going to answer also your question about what the learning protocol is, right? Typically, when you go into these machine learning techniques, they have a bunch of training examples, which I'm going to call XI. Where I is running through 1 to n. N is the number of examples that you are going to use to train the classifier, which is in the MNIST is 65,000. And then Y is going to be the class type, right? Which is going to be, you know, any number that is going from 0 to 10. But in this particular case, we are going to use plus 1 and minus 1 to establish the analogy with the SVMs, okay? So we are going to use only two classes, plus 1 and minus 1. Okay, so that's typically the setup, the problem you want to solve. You want to have a machine that gets this as an input, and as an output, it's going to tell you whether this is good, plus, or minus, bad. Okay. So SVMs have this nonlinear function that sends the input into a larger dimensional space. M is the dimension of the input space. Let's say that we have M antenna lobe neurons. And nu is going to be a high dimensional space that in some cases it can be infinite. Okay, but in our case, for the mushroom body, it's also high. This is This is often called in the SVM literature the feature states. And in our particular case, this is going to be the KC neural coding space. Okay, the classification function is going to be simply this function. This is the linear classifier, which is going to be the inner product. This is, you can replace it by this by a summatory over I. This W is going to be the connections from the KCs into the output neurons. So whenever there's sufficient representation of this particular odorant in the cases, then you have a plus one, otherwise you are going to have a low value. The idea is that this is going to be the output neurons, this is going to be the connections from the cases into the output neurons. I have a graph. I'm going to summarize it. So this is the SVM model, X here. Phi of X, those guys over there. And then the classification is happening in the output neurons. This is very simple classifier, okay? It's only 2 minutes.
There's a next, looks like there's another talk now.
Okay. So we have to... okay, guys. Basically, at the end, the message is that you can establish a very direct connection with the learning rules that you derive from SVM, which is these learning rules that you have from the stochastic gradient descent are very similar to the ones we use with Hebbian learning with some differences. Okay, so sorry, we got
there. Yeah, no, but it's okay. We can continue. I think there are probably people who...